What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of Soul Therapy, the podcast. My name is Daniel.
Daytona.
Today, we'll be talking about the iconic label and club Masterplan, and we'll also be reviewing Fauna's Phonetic 2 album. As usual, if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe to our podcast on all streaming platforms, and don't forget to give us that 5-star rating on Spotify as well. Also, for more contents, please go and follow our socials at soul_therapy, and also please support our page on Ko-fi at ko-fi.com/soul-therapy. Masterplan. For those who have no idea what Masterplan is, to me, Masterplan is one of the most iconic clubs, but not just a club, but it's like a label as well at the same time. This club label is kind of like the pioneer in terms of growing the hip-hop scene, kind of like the underground scene, but it's so prevalent and so important because if it wasn't for Masterplan, I don't think we would be having these types of conversation about the Korean hip-hop scene. That's how important Masterplan was. And I mean, there's just a lot of artists, and I feel like a lot of people kind of forego or kind of forget about Masterplan because it's been such a long time since, you know, people held conversations about Masterplan. And so for people who listen to like Korean hip hop, I'm sure people are familiar with artists like Side B, you know, DJ Soulscape, Born Kim, Juice Hawk, Infinite Flow, DJ Rex, Def Con, Red Rock,
you know, Vasco.
Vasco as well.
The old name of Bill's Dax, yeah.
Yeah, and there's so much more artists, but those guys are kind of like the essential guys who kind of paved the way to where hip-hop is today. And if it wasn't for them, again, like I said, we wouldn't be having these type of conversations because it just goes to show how important that club was. You know what I mean? It was like they were kind of like the hip-hop bugs. You know what I mean? Like they just kind of like just crawled around, you know, looking for ways to survive. And it's true because during that time, like Korea was never prone to hip-hop, nor hip-hop had a good image in Korea, or that's what at least people kind of perceived it as. You know, people kind of looked at hip-hop just as like this, who are you type of guys. They cast him as like an outsider. And so for them to kind of just stick around, to hold their ground and to stand firm and to create something like Masterplan, I think it's just so amazing. And I think it goes to show that we should never forget who Masterplan was. And I think it's important to have these types of conversation about Masterplan.
Mm-hmm.
This club and label was kind of also like a all about respect. You had to, it wasn't like some free club, you know, like these artists actually had to make their way into the club by earning the respect of their older ones and like earning the respect of the crowds. You can't just, it's like the Apollo Theater, you know what I mean? Kind of, but like a Korean version of like a little underground club. It wasn't just like a free type of pass. Like you had to work your way in. Like you had to be like a well-respected, well-rounded hip-hop artist, or else you'd kind of just be like, what are you doing here? So it wasn't like some type of, oh, hey, welcome, you're an artist? All right, welcome to... It wasn't like that. You literally had to work your way in. And it was a difficult process because, again, hip-hop was not popular back in the day. And so I'm sure a lot of these artists struggled just to make it into that club and label.
Like what Masterplan did for Korean hip-hop is definitely, it was crucial. Like without the existence of Masterplan, it would have all gone differently because this was basically the first blueprint of what the Korean underground was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Originally, it was a club called like Blue Oyster or something.
Mm-hmm.
The Korean name is like 푸른글 양식장. And that's, I don't know what 양식장 is in English, so... 푸른글 is like blue oyster. And the owner of this club was someone called Lee Jong-hyun. I think he went by the name of Don Money back in the day. And then now he's going by the name Sombrero. Like the dude has a very, with all his talents, I think he has a horrible sense in actually naming himself. But nowadays, Masterplan is defunct. Now I think it's kind of changed.
Happy Robot.
Yeah, it became called as Happy Robot Records. Mm-hmm. And they're also a kind of a like festival management company.
Mm-hmm.
There's a festival in Korea called Grand Mint Festival, GMF.
Right.
Yeah, that's these guys. Masterplan Music Group does that. And before all this, basically almost everyone you know has gone through Masterplan in one way, shape, or form. Like even this is not even in the case of exclusively like the underground scene either, because mm-hmm. for example, like Dynamic Duo. Before Dynamic Duo was a thing, they were used to be called CB Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And before CB Mass, actually, there was another group called KOD. Yep. And KOD defeated Masterplan.
Mm.
So even the most mainstream acts in this sense came from Masterplan. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like before the whole movement thing kicked off, like this happened here.
Right.
Even like Mithrajin from Epikai.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He was in a team called K Riders, I think. Mm-hmm. Although they weren't that prominent, but they he debuted through Masterplan too.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. MC Sniper, everything. So there was rarely an instance in which Masterplan wasn't in a rapper's career.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Jinpyo, who's more of known, mm-hmm. Known as a SMTM MC, but he's actually he had a career before this, and that was through Masterplan.
Essentially, the people that we listen to today all came from Masterplan. If you kind of think about it,
in one way, shape, or form, I wouldn't even go like that way,
mm-hmm.
Because you'll have to say it's definitely sure like the contemporary hip hop isn't exactly Masterplan influenced. I mean, mm-hmm. it's influenced, but it's not a direct influence.
Right.
Like, more of the OGs came through this place, is what I'm saying. Verbal Gent, Gent's crew, SMP, came through here as well. We don't hear about him anymore, but UMC, who was on the polar opposite of VJ, was also through here.
Mm-hmm.
Even the founders of Soul Company, like Kibi, went through here as well. And I think Masterplan was also responsible for putting out records as well.
Yeah.
I think they put out Bills Bosco, mm-hmm. Current day Bill Stacks. His first record, I think, came out of Masterplan.
A lot of the artists' music came from Masterplan, essentially.
Yeah. One Son as well.
Yep. Jusok.
Jusok. And Soulscape's first album, which is Classic Status.
You're right. The 180
that came
grams.
Out of, yeah. That also came out of Masterplan. But the problem was with Masterplan, this is actually an excerpt from One Sense interview, is that Masterplan really didn't waste money. Like, they put all mm-hmm. the money they can into making the music.
Yeah.
But when it comes to marketing it, they rarely had any expertise in it.
Yeah.
So I think that was one of the reasons in which Masterplan as a music record label didn't go that far.
Mm.
Like, it made great music, but it didn't actually market it that much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a problem.
Right.
But then again, this is an account of only one person who was going through it, so I'm not sure.
Right.
And like a lot of the rappers that came through Masterplan and was the biggest face of Masterplan is no longer rappers anymore. There was a guy called Born Kim.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And there was also a guy called Joe Brown. And mm-hmm. like Born Kim, I'm not sure exactly, but Joe Brown nowadays is more like a music video director.
I think Born Kim, he only had like a couple singles that was off of Masterplan's compilation album, and then he dropped like a couple singles on his own, but I don't think he ever made like a full-length album or even
I think EP. He has a mixtape somewhere or something.
Yeah, probably a mixtape.
Sure.
Yeah,
and they were incredibly talented people, so I just don't think that Masterplan's model of business was exactly sustainable.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, but then again, we got great record labels after that, so.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest surprise that I didn't know that was DEFCON. Like, I had no idea he was part of Masterplan.
I think it was through SNP, I think,
mm-hmm.
with VJ. Like, Verbal Gin and DEFCON were very close when they were like beginning their careers. So nowadays, they kind of, I think, grew apart. Because they went down different paths, but they were pretty inseparable during those early SMP days. And I think that kind of makes it default that DEF CON be a huge part of of Master Plan as well.
Yeah, and I also think for people who are listening to Korean hip-hop music now, I think they know because, like you know, we have, like, Seo Taiji, and, like, people label Seo Taiji as the kind of, like, the trendsetters, you know? And so, and, like, all the other hip-hop artists in the 90s, but I think you also have to, if you want to kind of dig deeper, definitely Master Plan is definitely up there because, again, if it wasn't for that label and that club, again, we wouldn't be sitting up here and, like, having all these amazing conversations about, you know, how much Korean hip-hop has grown. And, you know, we wouldn't even have, like you said, all the other labels like Soul Company or, you know, like Jungle Entertainment. Like, we wouldn't even have all that if it wasn't for Master Plan. They were kind of, like, to me, like, the glue of, like, the underground scene. Like, if it wasn't for that, everything would have just fell apart. And we wouldn't, I don't even know if we would have had Korean hip-hop to this extent. And so it's just crazy to me because I was watching Treasure's Road. For those that don't know Treasure's Road, it's like the member dynamic duo Treasure. He goes on like finding the best kind of like the local eatery, kind of pubs, restaurants, and he just kind of have like a conversation with different artists. And they had an episode with like a reunion with Master Plan, the founder Lee Jung-yeon. And I thought it was such a refreshing retake or revisit on kind of like their days in Master Plan. It was pretty cool to see. Like for me as a person who, you know, is getting to know more about Master Plan, how seminal and how important they were. It was really cool to see them reunite together and to like kind of witness kind of like what they went through just for like a brief moment when like Treasure was like, yeah, we were kind of like the parasites, you know, we were just like kind of like we were the outcasts. We were kind of like labeled as guys that wouldn't have made it from the public's view, you know. And so I think it's really cool to see where they were able to kind of just you know, have all these good conversations and to like, you know, kind of have like a small little reunion. And so, yeah, I think people should definitely take a listen to other songs from Master Plan's productions, especially Jusuk. I think Jusuk is one of the guys who long and gone, like been forgot about, especially because I don't know, Jusuk is one of the artists that kind of like brought in like that bling hip hop. You know, like that bling era hip-hop?
Yeah, it was really weird because his fashion sense and everything was like that. Yeah. But his lyrics are incredibly abstract. So it's like,
interesting.
Yeah, like if you look at the lyrics, I still don't understand it because it used very complicated words in a very disjointed fashion as well. So I was like, We always talked about on this podcast about how Korean hip hop had a problem when it comes to finding what it was actually supposed to talk about, right?
Yeah.
So I think that kind of abstraction kind of was a way of embodying a certain sense of rebellion against conventional order.
Right.
And I think Jusuk played a part in that. It's just that these days, like as much as I like abstract hip hop, Jusuk stuff oftentimes kind of reads as a bit of a word salad, you would say.
Word salad.
Yeah. Not all the times, but about, I say, like 3 to 4 times out of 10.
Okay.
It was really, it's very interesting. Like, you take the aesthetics, but of bling, you take blinger aesthetics, but actually don't talk about bling, but more about a sense of alienation or, I don't know. I mean, it was very interesting because the bling culture, the bling era in American hip hop especially, is kind of regarded as the downfall in a lot of sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
The period in which everything was fucked up. But because it kind of removed the socioeconomic kind of progressivism that hip hop used to have, right?
Yeah.
But it is very weird that the fashion came over as the same thing, but it represents a totally different thing in here because that period in Korean hip hop was actually way more progressive than it is now.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really weird. Another country's, like America's fashion statements in hip-hop regarded as being reactionary then was actually meaning something totally different here.
Mm.
So, I mean, it's very weird. I think this language barrier existed.
Mm-hmm.
And how should you say this? I think it's like this. Even during the bling era, in a sense, I think that I don't give a fuck attitude kind of persisted. Like that's, some will say it's a problem. I saw it as more of an, I think it was more of a natural progression.
Yeah.
Under a capitalistic dogma and a system, the people who are often perpetrators or people who benefit from the system somehow still think that they are fighting against the system, even though oftentimes because they had started from nothing.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So they blame the hierarchical people in position rather than the system itself.
Yeah.
And this is very natural. This is very intuitive, and this is very empirical.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say it's rational, but it is definitely empirical. You can't blame people for being empirical, right?
Yeah.
It's frustrating, but it is what it is. And I think that was why this kind of disparity or mismatch happened.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about it, Korean, the forefront, a lot of the people who are at the forefront of Korean hip hop wasn't exactly well-versed in English.
Yeah.
So I think they just got the sentiment of rebellion,
mm-hmm.
in which it actually wasn't, but there was that feeling, that sentiment that you were fighting against something remained in hip hop, even during the bling era, right?
Yeah.
It was, the problem was that it wasn't against the system anymore. It was more about the people that were somehow below them, or I don't know, a general sense of people, not people against the system, but people against the people in a sense. Right. But that subtext didn't exactly get translated through,
mm-hmm.
because it was Korean hip hop, because we were Korean. We didn't know that we weren't great in English. Yeah. Right? So if you think about it, it's completely understandable that rappers like Chuseok, with all that bling shit, with that kind of fashion aesthetic, he still rapped about the things he did. That's where the mismatch comes. If you really think about it, rappers like Verbal Jin, for example, he was actually fluent in English.
Mm.
You don't see him rocking jewels, right?
Yeah.
I think there's a reason to it. Although I'm not sure if Chuseok truly is not that fluent in English or not, I have no idea. But Chuseok was one of the many people who had that kind of fashion, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think that subtext was largely not read in Korean hip-hop. Interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Now it's more like the things are finally catching up.
Yeah.
So whether you think it's great or not, at least I'll say it's more consistent now.
Yeah, overall, I think this conversation about Master Plan, I think it was really important, because it just helps to understand, not just for us who are Korean, but I think for the viewers and the listeners tuning in, I think it's a good kind of like an educational kind of brief little lesson about, more in depth about like the Korean hip hop culture.
And yeah, so, definitely.
Yeah, so moving on, I think, you know, this is a album review that I kind of wanted to talk about for a while, and this is Fana's Phonetic 2 album, and
another Master Plan graduate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this album was wow. I was just so shocked when he announced that Phonetic 2 was going to drop. And I mean, Phonetic 1 is an instant classic. It's a masterpiece.
He named it well too. Like, instead of saying Phonetic 2, it's like two eyes.
Yeah. That was really smart on him. Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of dope.
Would you say this was a highly anticipated or highly awaited sequel, or was this like
this was actually sequel? Very highly anticipated.
Okay.
But the problem was, like, they announced this very way earlier. I think it was like 2 years ago almost.
Wow.
So it was like, man, this is gonna be Detox all over again, like that kind of shit. But it actually came out. The thing is, it's like this: people were beginning to forget about this because. Usually it was supposed to come out at the 10th anniversary of the first Phonetic album.
Right, right.
But the thing is, it didn't, because they were so busy. Vanna got newly married. Quiet had Show Me the Money stuff and new label stuff going on and everything. But then again, when they said they were going to drop the second Fnatic, like they announced it like a day before.
Yeah.
It was like everyone was surprised. Like, holy shit, they're just going to drop it out of the blue.
Yeah.
So like the community was on fire. Like, because Vanna never literally never disappointed.
Yeah.
I can't think of a single bad Vanna album. You know how we talked about how Korean rappers take much more time in making albums than a lot of rappers in the States do?
Yeah.
Because, first of all, it's Korean rappers are way more financially unstable in general.
Yeah.
Especially if you aren't a big name like Jay Park or something.
Yeah.
And, well, the album form isn't as cherished as in Korea as a lot of Western countries.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, granted, these days, I don't think that's the case for Western music as well. But anyway, but Hwana always kind of was very consistent in his own way.
Yeah.
He has like, if I'm correct, he has like 5 albums out.
5, yeah.
Yeah. Not many rappers in Korea have 5 studio albums.
Yeah.
That it really is a huge number when it comes to Korean hip hop. And having that kind of discography is, I don't know.
It's impressive.
Yeah, that's the word. It's very impressive. Granted, like, it's not just the album, but Fana's character alone.
Yeah.
He raps about the things he does. I won't say he's anti-capitalistic, but he's definitely not capitalistic-centered.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, that's a real rarity.
Yeah.
Even, I think, it's such a tragic thing, in a sense, because if you look at the American underground scene, you have rappers like, for example, like Armand Hammer.
Yeah. Or,
well, I won't say Griselda. Griselda is actually very pro-capitalist.
Earl Sweatshirt.
Earl Sweatshirt, that kind of things.
Yeah.
That isn't common here. And that's not on the rappers. That's more about what Korea is as a country.
Yeah.
It's very hard to survive in Korea being anti-capitalistic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even the poorest individual to the most richest individual, you will very, very hard pressed to find someone who is anti-capitalist because of our history and everything. I won't go too far into that. But anyway, and even the most conscious rappers have a certain sense of nihilism in their music, inadvertently and inevitably. They just have a different stance on money, but and just not stance, a different nuance in the way talk about money. But at the end of the day, a lot of the message surrounds that you have to get that money.
Mm-hmm.
Fana wasn't exactly that kind of person. Fana really inadvertently, out of purpose, or I don't know, he has a very strong message within his music that's more about not fuck the money, but at least some sort of sentiment saying that money isn't everything.
Exactly, yeah.
That is incredibly hard to find.
Uh-huh.
And although this album, he kind of seceded a little bit, I think it is still an amount that is very rare to see.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, I don't even blame him for that kind of little seceded succession, because dude stays so real for like how many years, I can't even count.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he deserves that money. If anyone deserves money, it's this guy. So,
yeah.
And at the end of the day, like, anti-capitalism doesn't mean you should be poor. Like, socialism is with no car, no house. Like, that's bullshit. Go fuck yourself if you're really thinking that. But this was just so good to see. Even, like, the production itself and the way he's rhyming on it. Like, he has been always the master rhymesmith, as we have been talking about it always. Like, for example, like, I'll actually recite some lyrics here. Forgive me the cringe. There is a song called Para, I think.
Yeah, Para, yeah.
Yeah, what track is that?
It was 11, Germination.
Yeah, it's called Germination, huh? Yeah, that's actually the exact, the right translation here. He uses the triple flow there.
Mm.
And let me look it up real quick. And every third 3 syllables, like the entire verse is broken down into 3 syllables.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, for example, like A, B, C, A, B, C, A, B, C, A, B, C.
Mm-hmm.
That pattern does not miss a single word, a single letter.
Mm.
Like, it's daisy chained so closely together.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just listen to it. I know you will not understand the lyrics here, but listen to, like, and it will feel like it's rhyming because the vowels rhyme here. 맘대로, 과대포, 장대고, 황폐로, 바랜저, 파내벼, 과대면, 할대면, 낮게도, 아래로. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It sounds like it's rhyming, right?
Yeah.
The thing is, like, this isn't just words. Like, I just recited a whole sentence.
Mm.
This is a single sentence. Wow. He does this for the entirety of the first verse.
Wow.
So it goes like this. 맘대로 과대포 장대고 황폐로 바랜저 파내며 과대면 할 때면 낮게도 아래로 향했던 나의 역할 계속 파내려 가겠죠 차에서 안에서 약했던 싸게서 사생교 다니쳐 가겠어 사생적 한계점 앞에서 like
that's crazy.
Yeah, there's not a single letter that doesn't rhyme here on an entire verse.
That's ridiculous.
This guy truly is the MF Doom of our of Korean hip hop.
Oh yeah, no doubt.
And it makes perfect sense, and it's very poetic as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this kind of lyrical mastery I have never seen ever. Like, for example, other rhymesmiths like P-Type, for example.
Yeah.
P-Type is also a very intricate rhymer.
Mm-hmm.
But not to this point.
Oh, no, like, no.
He's very poetic. He's very accomplished in rhyming as well. But he's more like the Big Pun kind of guy.
Yeah.
Big Pun being a great rhymer wasn't, this is a personal opinion, but he's never on like Doom's level of intricacy.
Mm.
Like, this is Doom level shit.
Yeah.
Like, how, it's harder to find words that he didn't rhyme
throughout
his entire verse. And to hear this kind of lyrical mastery again is very refreshing.
It is, yeah.
Because I've missed this kind of circus kind of thing, actually.
Oh, same here, yeah.
Yeah. This almost inhuman level of ingenuity is always good to see.
It is, yeah.
Truly, like, the potential and how far the art form of hip-hop can go. Like,
yeah.
This is, especially in Korean hip-hop, like, I mean, if you think about it, like, back in the, like, 90s, late 90s and early 2000s,
mm-hmm.
we had, like, college professors saying, you will never be able to rhyme in Korean.
Mm.
That shit was on like local newspapers and stuff.
Wow.
Like, it was all a part of like the establishment trying to shit on like newer subcultures.
Uh-huh.
Like, you'll never be able to rhyme properly in Korean. Like, it's possible in English, but because it's Koreans don't finish their sentences with nouns, it will be impossible. But then you get examples like this. Right. We have come so far. And I can't help but feel kind of a little proud about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how he does this. Seriously, yeah, I look at his lyrics and it's like, how did you make all this rhyme?
It's crazy. Like,
yeah.
When I'm listening to this album, like, the one track that really stuck out, of course, I agree, Germination was definitely one of the tracks, but there's another track called Green is the New Black, which features Sway D, Take One, Zen of the Zilla, and Bill Stacks.
Yeah,
and granted,
the Posse Code.
And granted, some of the featurings was, it was decent, but the production to that track was just, like, what the heck? It felt very old school, but at the same time, new in a way, because you're adding in like the new artists, but also, you know, you bring in the veterans who associated to Fauna.
I think it was more about the drums are kind of contemporary.
Yeah.
But the sample usage, I don't think it was old school necessarily, but it was definitely eclectic. And
it was, yeah.
And I think in this age of music, eclecticism kind of translates into old school stuff, like, because nowadays it's like more about splicing.
Yeah.
So like unconventional samples are automatically like kind of remind you of older stuff, even though it's not exactly older stuff, like if you do a direct comparison. But I think that kind of eclecticism is something that we're missing, and this track gave me that. And I also love, like, how everyone involved actually has a connection with the word green.
Green, yeah. That's what I was going to say. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, Sway D always talked about green stuff, like, even back in, like, Green Club days with the collaboration with Be Free. And Take One has, obviously, an album called Green Ideology.
Yep.
Bill Stacks is the leading weed legalization guy. Zen of the Zilla, the green hair guy. Yeah, so it's like, and Fauna, also dyed his hair green. Yep. I think he is going with the green thing as well.
The Green Goblin, as he calls himself, the Green Goblin. Yeah,
exactly. So it filled perfectly.
Phantom Funk was crazy too, but Justice, that sample usage, what the heck, dude, that was insane.
Justice was kind of disappointing me for a little while there. I mean, not this track, but like these days, what was that single?
The NFT one for the...
Yeah, I mean, like...
Yeah,
I know what you mean. Aside from the whole NFT thing, if I have to rant on NFTs, like this episode will end, but... The song was just
what you mean.
God awful.
Yeah,
go on.
It definitely was a throwaway track.
This is not even a sentiment of mine. Like the community, and even not, I'm not talking about the like hip hop community only here, because like Justice is now a kind of a household name at this point. Like literally everyone hated that song.
Yeah,
it's not because the song is like not that great, it's like it's actively cringy.
Yeah,
like maybe you'll foreign listeners will not catch up on this, because if you're not familiar with Korean, but the way he just structured his words and pronounces it, everything was like so fucking corny. And like with the horn stuff too, like boo, 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 like fuck, it was so bad. It was literally like the worst track of last year for me. Top 10 worst tracks, if I have to make it, that shit is number one. It was so cringy. But what he did here kind of is what he's supposed to do.
Yeah.
Don't do that weird bullshit. Like you can't sing. Like your sense of melodies aren't that great either. Like stick to this. Like when you do this, you sound great, is what I'm saying. And it was a very throwback beat too. Like this isn't some East Coast contemporary boom bap. This is like far back in the 80s kind of boom bap.
Yeah.
This is like LL Cool J shit. And it worked perfectly. Like, I honestly thought, like, when I first heard the beat, I was like, maybe he's going too far. But as like the first verse and everything's coming through, yeah, this is great. He killed it.
And then the track towards the end, View, featuring Palo Alto and The Quiet. I think that was definitely kind of a throwback to Fana's first album. Just kind of the overall structure and the production to the song. And I also really love the piano chord that was used throughout the entirety of the song. And this song really almost felt more of like a... you know how we talked about how we both get confused still in terms of listening to Fana's music and like what he's trying to convey? But I think this one kind of eases off on that complexity, because this one feels a bit more like a... like a self reflection of how far he has come.
He isn't that abstract as much. There are a lot of, I mean, not a lot, but I think there is some less coded stuff in here.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, I like coded stuff a lot, but some directness is always appreciated, especially if the subject matter is great. View is one of them. Like, View was actually like that song that I just talked about how Fana was deserving of all the money he has, right?
No doubt, yeah.
Like, this is one of I think 2810.
Yeah, 20. Oh, yeah.
Was also about that. Like, 2810 is basically the amount of, by the way, the money he had in his account. Wow. And 2810 won is like $2.
Wow.
And this is a story narrative about how one day he looked at his account and all he had was $2. Despite being a pretty well-renowned underground rapper with multiple albums. And it's like, if anyone has to make it, it was this guy. And I think this kind of success arc that we're seeing with Fana, because he never really compromised.
No, yeah.
Because like compromise is a huge kind of sentiment in Korean hip-hop with a lot of controversy.
Of course, yeah. Like
the D-Flow Justice, we already explained this.
Yeah. Right?
But Fana never did. Yeah. He literally never did. Like, even The Quiet, for example, the reason why The Quiet isn't getting bashed on like D-Flow is that he never really hated the sense of going on TV. Never explicitly said so.
Uh-huh.
And at the end of the day, his music didn't really go the Korean pop way of having a singer on your hook and doing everything, stuff like that. But Hana is on another level in that shit because he was on, like, I think Show Me the Money 1 or 2 as a feature.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
I think he did a feature for Mad Clown. But that was it. And this was, like, Show Me the Money 2. So it wasn't before, like, Show Me the Money was that huge.
Yeah.
So I think no one cares about that anyway. And he almost never went. I think he never went on TV, actually.
Never.
He never tried to make music for the charts. He's responsible for the Ugly Junction.
Yes.
With what little he has, he always used it all for the culture instead of himself.
Yeah.
And he still managed to put all these great albums out.
Was Ugly Junction kind of like Masterplan in ways?
In a ways, yes. There's actually a very cute video of Jackie Y when she was a trainee of some sorts. Not exactly trainee, that would be the wrong way to put it. When she was like a super rookie.
Okay.
And she's rapping on boom bap stuff. And there's a footage on YouTube where she has no makeup on and everything. Like, she's like, I think, like 18 years old in that video or something.
Mm-hmm.
And Fana and his crew, I think a couple of his friends is feeding her like food and shit like that.
Oh.
Buying her some stuff. Like, and when I was looking at that video, it was like, damn, like, how many people did he put on? Number one.
Yeah.
Number two, like, he was really there from the start. Like, he recognized Jackie Y like before she even knew how to use autotune.
Yeah.
That's crazy if you think about it.
No,
considering the influence that Jackie Y has had in Korean hip hop.
Same thing with Kundi Panda. He's went through Ugly Junction
exactly.
as well.
Yeah, exactly. This isn't like picking up people when they were like already hot on SoundCloud.
No.
This is like really trying to dig in before it actually blew up in at all in whatever platform it is. Nobody has been realer than him.
Yeah.
Ever. Even E-Sense.
Yeah.
Like, I explained like way in my earlier podcast how like E-Sense is considered the pinnacle of realness, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about it, like, even E-Sense had the Supreme Team thing going on. The reason he could have afforded them realness is because he had a period in which he had to totally sell himself out.
Yeah.
The reason he's considered the realist is because he's the first one to, in a sense, to sort of like, that was actively tortured by that.
Yeah.
And disavowed it through his independent career of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But Fana didn't even go through that. Like,
true.
No exposure, no nothing, whatever it is. Like, this is the definition of underground. This is the definition of what we call underground. And this is obviously a very good way of reminding me of it. Like, I think his first album came out in, like,
2009.
That's 12 years, 13 years?
13 years, man.
13 years of, like, literally going through all sorts of bullshit, going through having to be poor, going through having to, and still be so distributive enough to people who think he had potential. Like, actively showing us what a community is.
Yeah.
This is amazing. And not once did his alt falter in that process.
Yeah. I think the final track, the one following after View, Yoramgi, I think might be his only kind of like the trap type of song that he has, which is still cool.
Was it trap? I'm not sure.
Yeah, because it was produced by co-produced with Boy Cold.
Yeah.
So it kind of has like that.
Isn't that the piano?
Yeah.
Is it that mainstream though?
I mean, for what he has though, that's what I'm saying. Like, in terms of like the whole.
Yeah,
Fanatic 2 album, I think like that's the only song where you can hear a little bit of like that a mainstream kind of like delivery and that flow. But I mean, I'm not saying like that's like bad or anything. I'm just saying like it's kind of like cool that he has like a song that's like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because in all of his other songs, it's like staying true to Fana.
Yeah, I think like Yoramgi, especially the lyrical contents of it, like kind of a panorama view of his like life, I think. That was great. There were a little bit of surprises here as well. I thought Basic would do a verse, but he ended up doing the hook.
Yeah, BFG.
It was actually, that was a very catchy hook as too. Like, I never knew Basic had it in him to do this.
Yeah.
It worked perfectly. And like I said, like, there's some very direct stuff here as well. like mm-hmm. 광흥청에서, like 광흥청 is where the Ugly Junction was located.
Mm.
It was about his like the sense of duty he felt he had for the hip hop community. Like it's very well addressed in there.
Yeah.
화석, the first fossil,
mm-hmm.
that track. Considering like because this concept of aging within the hip hop scene, aging as an artist has always been a very dominant theme in Fana's music.
Yeah.
And I think this album of sorts is kind of an absolution moment.
Yeah.
Like from the start, he is like, he's still on that fossil shit, but I think he realizes his place within the scene. That's true. Great. 담배가 모자라. Like I ran out of cigarettes. Is that the English title?
Yeah.
Yeah. That one is actually very self-reflective, classic Fana. Chai, he's just rhyming his ass off. Alumar being like the dejected and the anthem.
Yeah.
Like Alumar is about not fitting in, the zebra thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as a person who has often felt that way, like that was like everything I want from Fana. Like that was my favorite track here, Alumar. With that soul sample, that was great.
Yeah.
That was amazing. Pala, obviously, Germination, amazing track. I can't think of a single track that I don't like here.
Yeah. I mean, everything kind of like pinpoints back to like the first one, you know, because like making a sequel album is kind of difficult, you know, as though it is with movies.
Yeah. And so, at the end of the day, though, if you think about it, like it was very different from the first album.
Very different, yeah.
Because the first album is like, it's not exactly a very personal album.
No, not at all.
It's more about like, that's why I always kept bringing up Doom. Is because Doom's music oftentimes is more about playing a character, right?
Yeah.
It's about being a supervillain and asserting dominance in a sense.
Yeah.
Of course, when he bears his soul, you can see it and it's very heartbreaking and stuff like that. But that's not the main persona of that shit.
Yeah.
And I always viewed Pana as that kind of guy.
Yeah.
And I think this persists through like the first two albums.
Mm-hmm.
But starting from his third, he becomes very personal. And the absolute pinnacle of that was the fourth album, which is Fan Abyss.
Yeah.
And look at the title, it says Abyss. Like that album is very dark, brooding almost. Like you really like it's like kicking himself into the abyss. Like from what I know, like during that album, like he was going through like panic disorder.
Okay.
Yeah. He had like depression was a given at that point. He had panic disorders and stuff like that, and it shows. And that was when really Juana started being like, I was really resonating with Juana. Like his music has been responsible for keeping me alive in very depressive times. And this album, I think he started to picking up being a little more lighter.
Yeah.
So it's like the perfect blend of like the emotional Juana and the lyrical, like the technician of Juana is. Mm-hmm. So it's like a kind of a sum up of his entire career.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to see the evolution, whether you like the first album more or second album more. One thing you have to like admit in a sense is that he changed in the best way possible.
Overall, I think we're super excited where his career is now going to go now that he's signed under Daytona Entertainment. And so hopefully, you know, there's going to be a lot more, I guess, hope and excitement for him in the long run with the type of music that he'll bring after the really, really impressive Phonetic 2 album. So, super excited. And as we begin to slowly wrap up our show, as usual, any artists or tracks that you're currently listening to and would like to share or recommend to our listeners? I mean, since we're talking about Fana and his Phonetic 2 album, might as well just go back to his first album, Phonetic 1. And I'm going to go with his kind of like his closing track, Semsota, which is track number 12. This is definitely, like you said, in the whole album in Phonetic 1, it's really just about him just rapping. And then I think Semsota kind of like is like a good closure to that album, like a more lighter tone, because all the other ones were like darker, very spooky kind of tone to it. But this one definitely brought a little bit more light to it. And I thought, you know, it was a kind of a good closing song, kind of like focusing on him being at a Soul Company and, you know, working with The Quiet and stuff. And I think The Quiet produced this track. The Quiet's vocals were on there too, just a little bit. But I think overall, this was, Semsota was like one of the more, I would say, hidden gems compared to like Rhymonic Storm or like, you know, Masquerade. This was definitely one of the more sleeper tracks. So definitely go check out this track. It's a lot more lighter than his other tracks in that album.
That title is actually a punchline because...
Oh, okay.
Samsota means like to rise.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if you look at the word, it's sem, comma, sota, right?
Yeah.
Like samsota, it like without the comma means to rise as well. But sota is also means rise as well. And the sam in front of it, the sem, the sam is actually the mascot for Seoul Company.
Oh.
Because if you look at the Seoul Company logo, there's a bird on it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that bird is called Sam.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
So it's like Sam Rise. So it was about, it was basically like Juana's kind of homage to Seoul Company because he was a big part of Seoul Company.
Yeah.
And that was before like the whole debacle happened. That was in the initial stages of Seoul Company. So in which like they all were a very tight community.
Mm-hmm.
So that has that significance. You know what? If we're talking about Juana, I will go with, there is this album called song, the sixth track in there.
Mm-hmm.
What's it called in English?
Guiding Star.
Guiding Star. That's exactly the literal translation of the song. The title is QWBR. The literal translation is Guidance Song. This is one of his most, I think, emotionally potent songs.
Okay.
You know how like when you close your eyes, you see lights?
Yeah.
Like he's talking about those lights.
Oh.
Like he's seeing them as guiding stars. Like the whole concept of the track is like, he's feeling left alone. He thinks like time is moving on, the age, the epoch, like the age is changing, the world is changing around him, and I think he feels like he can't keep up.
Mm.
And if you ever come to Seoul, you realize you'll never see stars.
Mm.
We live in a very industrialized society.
Yeah.
The atmosphere is so dirty, we can't see stars anymore.
Mm.
And in that sense, I think this song is about like, he sees stars when he closes his eyes.
Mm.
He can't see stars in the sky anymore. He feels like, he feels lost in this world. And this song is about how like, when you close your eyes, there's still stars there in the night.
Mm-hmm.
Like that kind of metaphor is where it starts. And that's such a beautiful way of looking at things.
Yeah.
Even when he was in the like lowest throes of like panic depression.
Yeah.
And the beat and everything is perfect. The lyrics are perfect. The way his voice delivers is perfect.
Yeah.
I strongly suggest if there's a translation to it, like look up the lyrics to it as well. This song helped me through so many tough times.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is like Kid Cudi level of life saving shit. You know what I mean?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So the whole album is of course great, but the Guiding Stars alone, like, oh man, like this is still on my playlist these days. Like whenever I feel down, whenever I feel like, especially in this crazy ass world, this is still a staple for me. I'm pretty sure I'm going to listen to it someday, especially me being alone in Virginia these days. Yeah, this is such a great song. Strongly recommend it. I mean, at this point, I'll have to say this song is a part of my soul, in a sense, a part of who I am. Like, definitely check it out. If you're going through dark times, this is the song for you. Definitely. I'm sure you're going to find solace in it. Even if you don't understand the lyrics, I think you'll kind of get what I mean just by listening to it. The vibe is there. So
for sure.
Yeah. Great song. Man, I I can't even remember how many times I heard this crossing the Hangang Bridge and shit. Like it's definitely a kind of a, what do you call it? A moment in time kind of song for me. This like, and E-Sense's Flight, like those two songs just, there's an anthem in my life, some sort. So definitely recommend it.
Well, that's all the time we have for today, but please do comment and let us know what you think of the topics that we talked about today. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please go and subscribe to our podcast on all platforms and please give us that 5-star rating. If you want more K-hip-hop contents, please go and check out Daytona's Instagram at myk_Daytona for K-hip-hop album reviews. Also, please follow our social media page at Seoul_Therapy. Thank you guys so much and see you guys next time. Peace.